The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating more than a half century of promoting awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
Welcome to this evening's discussion of the new book, The Birth of Korean Cool, with author Yuni Hong and The Wall Street Journal online columnist Jeffrey Yang. We're really looking forward to tonight's talk on this book, which has been described as a hilarious, gutsy, eye-opening account of Korean drive and success. Yuni will be available to sign books after the discussion. Quickly, Yuni Hong is a journalist and author with international experience in web, print, and television news. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal Europe, International Herald Tribune, New Republic, Boston Globe, and The Forward. She's the author of one previous book, the novel Kept, a comedy of sex and manners, and she's fluent in English, French, German, and Korean. Our moderator, Jeff Yang, is also a regular contributor to CNN Opinion and can be heard frequently on radio as a contributor to shows such as PRI's The Takeaway and WNYC's The Brian Lehrer Show?
Lehrer.
Sorry. Okay. He is the author of the New York Times bestselling I Am Jackie Chan, My Life in Action, and The Action Hero's Official Autobiography, as well as several other bestsellers, and most recently edited the graphic novel anthologies Secret Identities and Shattered. Thank you and enjoy.
Thank you. Yay. thank you guys for coming out. Before Le Deluge. Apparently it's going to rain later. This is going to be, I think, a really incredibly interesting conversation, and I'm truly honored to have this opportunity to share the stage with the illustrious Yuni Hong. Before we start, though, what I just want to make sure how much time we have, because I know that some of you guys are probably burning with questions, and I want to make sure that there is the opportunity for you guys to interrogate Yuni as well.
Or him.
Okay, so maybe we'll talk for 30 minutes and then open up. Okay, sounds good. Mm-hmm. So so that actually leads us nicely segueing to the beginning of our conversation. And I just wanted to begin by asking you about the birth of Korean Cool. what actually inspired you to write the book?
Is my agent here? Because that's kind of the answer to 99 out of 100 questions you ask an author. Genuinely, I was being pressed for another book. And at the same time, I was actually working on a couple of books, but they were all about France. I had no intention of writing about Korea. I was working on a novel, which I can discuss because I promised myself that I would never finish it because it's terrible. It was a monastic murder mystery.
Wow.
it was basically a ripoff of The Name of the Rose, involving a secret formula for a liqueur, and it's like KFC, right? Nobody has the whole recipe. Three monks like divide the recipe, and then they keep getting murdered. And so I was working on that, and people say you should write a book about Korea, and I said no, I'm working on this really important book about these dead monks. So when the song and video Gangnam Style came out, people would keep sending it to me, and I would just sort of watch the first 5 seconds and just delete, because I just had a really unpleasant time living in Korea, and it's just not something that I needed a song written about, you know. And then a couple months later, I happened to mention casually to an editor that I actually grew up in Gangnam, which is the district in Seoul that the song is about, which is described, I've seen it described as the Beverly Hills of Seoul, which always makes me laugh. But I guess that kind of gives you the idea. And she literally yelled at me and said, "Why did you wait this whole time to tell me that you're from Gangnam?" I said, "Who cares?" And she said, "No, you have to write about growing up there." And I said, "I can't think of anything less interesting, you know, to me, let alone to anybody else." I mean, I think what I find about most people is they think their childhoods are not that interesting. I think that's probably universally true. Other people apparently do think that these things are interesting. So I wrote an article. It ran in the Quartz and then the Atlantic. And then at the same time, I have two agents. My UK agent said, so I was wondering if you had another book idea. And I wrote the laziest book proposal in the world, which is I forwarded her this article. And so that became this book. I guess Sai, who's on the cover, I guess I owe him a debt of gratitude. we did meet. Actually, I think I was with you when I met him. Yeah. I showed him the cover. He kind of didn't seem too happy about it.
Well, I tried to homage Sai over here with a hero. I think that, and this is my own critical rave around the book, I think that, you know, one of the things that's really incredible about it is how, despite your resistance in doing so, your story really does kind of recapitulate a lot of what Korea's own birth, or the birth of you know, contemporary Korea, represents, in the sense that you are really, I think, wittily and brilliantly journeying through your own sometimes unpleasant memories, but at the same time articulating how that very unpleasantness, the restrictions and the aspiration and the frustration that Korea experienced in that era ended up becoming the drive in a lot of ways for Korea to raise up itself and its popular culture and to export it to the world. And in the green room, we were talking about this. This is, in fact, a moment in history, a signal one, not just because Korea has become so wildly popular in Asia, in beyond Asia, in Europe, in Africa, in Latin America, globally, but because they've done so through sort of main force of will, that this is the first time that you've actually seen, in a lot of ways, a country bootstrap itself using soft power into global domination, global relevance, and then hope we're seeing domination emerge, and that's kind of incredible. I mean, it's something which other countries have tried to do, but when they've done so primarily as an attempt to lure people to their country, a tourism-focused thing. I think it was the first time that Korea, through its culture, through a ministry devoted to exporting that culture, has essentially proven that you can, in fact, fashion an exportable popular culture that the world will key into, connect with, and adore in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that. What was it that actually led to both the birth of Korean Cool and its current staggering popularity, both here in the U.S. and around the world?
I even having written the book, I don't think I really understand it, because it was a sort of a perfect storm of the state that we are in at the internet now is probably 90% of the story. Meaning that, you know, for the first time in history, the current generation is viewing the world with a sense of immediacy, right? Their idea of foreignness is completely different from when we were growing up. Their idea of something just being from another country or being exotic, that's been dismantled because their friends send them things in, you know, these video links, or they post on Twitter or Facebook. And if they say, whatever, this is hilarious, then you'll click on it and you won't be, oh, this is from another culture, I do not know this language, you know. So that opened the way for the first time in modern history for a non-English speaking country to possibly pose a second option to American pop culture. You know, because you know, these barriers were broken down because of the immediacy of the web, and to some extent, this is what Korea was anticipating when they, in the 90s, decided that they were going to make a priority of being the number one internet-wired country in the world, mm-hmm. which is sort of a weird idea. It was right after the Asian financial crisis, right? And they were so embarrassed by it being in debt and having to borrow money from the IMF that it was called the National Day of Mourning. Mm-hmm. And the president said that he was whipping himself every day because he was just so embarrassed. So, you know, so the whole, they had to rethink their economic strategy, and they decided, the president at the time, Kim Dae-jung, decided, okay, we're going to be the number one wired country in the world in internet. That was the first thing. And the second thing is, we're going to make Jurassic Park. And basically,
Jurassic Park, but Park will be actually the Korean last name Park.
Right, it'll be the presidential family. So that was kind of a weird idea because in the 90s they wanted Korea wanted to enter a field where the playing field was level, where no country had any obvious advantage over any other country, and they wouldn't have to play catch up. And that's where the internet thing came in, and they said, okay, there's something in telecommunications called Metcalfe's Law. Mm-hmm. Which states that a new technology for communicating is only useful if it achieves a critical mass of users. Yeah. Right. And Korea was aware of this, and they said, well, we're not going to wait until the free market makes people realize internet is really cool and, you just hope for the best. We're just going to have wire the entire country at the same time. So they laid down fiber optic cable, and they wanted 100% internet saturation immediately. So they, even in places that only recently maybe had phones, they were suddenly having internet access. And if you couldn't afford it, there were government subsidies. And it became the first 100% saturated nation. The Jurassic Park plan, I'm using that only half-kiddingly. In 1993, Jurassic Park came out. And then there were all these, the economists of Korea came up with a white paper saying, the amount of money that Jurassic Park made is the same as selling 15 million Hyundai cars. It can't be that hard to make a movie. this is sort of the underlying spirit is this pure chutzpah. This is a country that 60 years ago now, it was one of the poorest countries in the world. It was poorer than most of South Sahara Africa. And now they're saying, well, if they can make Jurassic Park, we can do it. But we can do it better. We can do it cheaper. And that's where the K-pop thing came from. They didn't really have a Jurassic Park, but they're actually working on something similar to Industrial Light and Magic. And the government is subsidizing that. So it would be like if Obama gave George Lucas billions of dollars to make Jurassic Park 7 or something. And that's basically what's happening in Korea. So
they didn't have Jurassic Park, but they had Jin-Young Park, right? So, I think one of the things that is interesting, even the backstory here, mm-hmm. is that there are certain kind of characteristics or values that are behind this. I mean, the very notion of chutzpah, which it is an ancient Korean word for, no, just but you know that there
for
cojones. Are cojones, yeah. Another Korean. No. But the idea that there are particular traits mm-hmm. that Korea has culturally that have been passed down through generations that have emerged out of the very kind of primordial mm-hmm. context of Korea, and that's what has enabled this special phenomenon to occur. That, I think, is one of the most fascinating things about the book. And you talk about certain things. You talk about, for instance, Confucianism and how the Confucian society that Korea continues to actually adhere to in main part was one aspect of it. You talk about another aspect, which is an emotion or a psychological character called Han, right? And that also played a big role in this notion of Korea wanting to prove itself out of its dire poverty and saving its face, if you will. Mm-hmm. Can you describe a little more about that?
Okay, Han. aside from questions about Kim Jong-un, I think the thing that about which I don't have very much to say, the thing I get most asked about in the book is actually Han. So Han is a word that I guess you would translate as rage or vengeance. And for the book, I interviewed director Park Chan-wook, who is just amazing and a big favorite of mine. I'm sure a lot of you are fans of his too. And I said, can you define Han? Because a lot of his films are about revenge. And he said, Han is a very particular kind of vengeance. And it's a feeling that comes from knowing that you can never actually achieve it. So it's sort of like you know that it's not going to make you feel better and you do it anyway. As you can imagine, it's not healthy. Han actually literally can kill you. There's a disease that Han creates called Huabyong, which I'm not kidding, is in the Diagnostic Standards Manual, which is the Bible of the American Psychiatric Association. It's actually a real disease, and you die from it. It's basically dying from anger. But this, I think, has a lot to do with Korea's success, not just economic success in the last 60 years, but with the Korean Wave as well, because you have to be kind of crazy to think, it's kind of like it's like what any vigilante movie is about, like the sort of the unassuming person suddenly has superhuman strength. And because they're just really, really focused on killing the person who slayed his family or whatever, and that you cannot afford to think about, oh, do I really have the wherewithal to do this? Is this really a smart thing to do? What is the payoff in the end? If you think about that, you lose focus. And a lot of the Korean drive, and this is a very touchy subject, but a lot of it had to do with wanting to beat Japan. Mm. This is a 600-year-old rivalry. That's, another topic this is a very, very complicated topic. It's one of the most bizarre continuing rivalries. Because if you think about it, France and England fought a war for 100 years, okay? But they're obviously fine now. I mean, they're allied. Hey. Aside from fine-ish. But, Korea and Japan... genuinely hate each other. The animosity is very, very real. Like when there was a huge nuclear meltdown, and I'm blanking out on the name of the.
After the tsunami in Japan.
Yes. Thank you. Right. Okay. After that, there was a famous Korean pastor, who was really, really powerful in Korea. He said, "This is punishment, divine punishment for what Japan did to Korea." And obviously he was heavily criticized by the press, but he wasn't the only person who thought this. He was just the only person who said it. Korea wanted to beat Japan at something, but, this is the end of history. This is a world of liberal democracy and Korea and Japan are allies. Even if it's in name only, Korea cannot just invade Japan. That's not going to happen. They can't hegemonize it. They can't really do anything. All they could really do is beat it economically. Well, two fronts, economically and in the coolness stakes.
Right.
This was hugely, hugely, hugely important to them. And just to, as a piece of evidence, just to show you that I'm not making this up, when Sony was coming up with its plan of attack in the 90s, it benchmarked, not Sony, sorry, Samsung. Sorry.
The other one.
Yeah. It's like people asking me if I'm Chinese. I'm so sorry. When Samsung was coming up with this plan of attack in the 90s, it benchmarked Sony as the company that it wanted to beat in terms of market cap. It didn't say, okay, we have to beat Microsoft. We have to beat Apple or U.S. Steel. They said, no, Sony. Right. And they said, we're going to do this by 2005. And Forbes ran an article in 2002 saying, this sounds completely off the wall. They use the term off the wall. A year later, they actually beat Sony's market cap. 3 years later, they doubled Sony's market cap. And it's very, very significant that they benchmarked a Japanese company. It's the same thing with the pop culture wars, the exact same thing.
And yet at the same time, I mean, it's both a relationship that's fraught with historical and contemporary tension,
right,
but also one which is, I mean, amazingly commensal, at least on the popular culture side, because some of the biggest consumers of K-pop and the earliest ones were Japanese consumers. Mm-hmm. In fact, to the point where it was a huge talked about phenomenon in Japan. That Japanese housewives were aspiring to meet and marry Korean men because Korean men were the ideal husbands, the most gentle, the most, gentlemanly individuals in the world, all based on what they saw in K-dramas, right? And all those are documentaries, so we know that's all true. But...
Yeah, there's a lot of terminal disease with young lovers. It's a chronic problem, yeah.
But nevertheless, Yon Sama, right, and Winter Sonata. Tell us about the phenomenon of Korean drama and how that ended up becoming such a an exportable product throughout the Asian region and then ultimately around the world. How did that even happen?
Right. I mean, there are people who say that the Korean wave actually started with dramas. Pop music is what you hear most about in the media, but the real ambassador was the dramas, and it actually, well, the very first one was in Japan, in Hong Kong, rather, in China, in the 90s, and they were so uninterested in showing a Korean drama that the Korean government had to subsidize translation. And they said, we'll just pay for everything, we'll sell ad space for you, all you have to do is put the tape in and press play, you don't have to do anything. And only under these terms would ATV, which is the Hong Kong network, would they show this drama, which was called, I forgot, whatever, it doesn't matter. But, and it immediately they got hooked. And what's kind of weird and sort of disturbing about the K-dramas in Asia is that, well, there are different reasons why people like them. And what I was told was, in Hong Kong, it was a revelation because, I don't know if this is true, but supposedly in Hong Kong, men make dinner. Yeah. Okay. And I guess, and they were watching these Korean dramas and the women were making dinner, and there was this sort of like bizarre, perverse sexual revolution where the men were saying, I don't want to make dinner for you anymore. So I'm like, I don't know if that's apparently this was the ripple effect. This was the Yonsama effect. I mean, whatever, the analog to the Yonsama effect, but in the Hong Kong world. In Japan, that was just bizarre. It was sort of, it defies logic, it defies common sense, it defies history. I think in any country, the people who control the remote control are women, housewives in particular. And it was about the guys. You know, it wasn't so much the storyline. I mean, they're beautiful women, but that wasn't why it was about. It was always about the guys.
I mean, to the point where there were essentially like sex tours, right? Where lonely housewives would fly to Korea to, you know, to prey on unsuspecting Korean men or something. You know, however it started, it got to be a phenomenon such that even like the Prime Minister of China and so forth, notably was talking about, how he never missed a particular K-drama. And the Prime Minister of Japan, you know, compared himself in popularity to Yonsama, right?
Right.
So, I mean, clearly something was happening then. And yes, it was stage managed to a certain degree or subsidized by the Korean government. But it wouldn't have been possible if it weren't for the fact that the actual works were addictive and appealing and aspirational. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before the IMF and the fact that an entire generation was more or less lost. A generation of investment was sort of went off the rails when that happened. Mm-hmm. One of the things which I think we've talked about before and I've written about is that there was this moment where all these projects had been set in motion, you know, because everything's a 5-year plan. So they have all these pre-rolled budgets. And then when the IMF crisis occurred, all these people were falling on their knives, sometimes literally, at the highest senior levels of these companies, leaving middle managers and junior folks to basically go off and do whatever they wanted without the kind of repressive, restrictive, you know, fetch tea for us for 20 years before you can start creating anything worthwhile type of apprenticeship. And that was actually the period in which you saw this fluorescence of creativity in film and in video games and in a wide range of other activities. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in some ways kind of the interesting story of disruption in Korea. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, the question now is, we've gotten to a point where Korea has established a platform. It's a global platform. But to a certain extent, some people wonder if it's, you know, forever or if it's just a phase, right? What's your take around that?
It doesn't matter whether it's forever because that the whole plan to begin with was about creating Korea the brand. So the pop culture products, film, movie, drama, fashion, and so forth, with the Korean label and with the characters using Samsung phones, that's sort of just an entry point to get people to associate Korea with cool. So, I mean, no pop music fad really lasts forever. I mean, I'm going to be very unpopular for saying this, but K-pop itself in 5 years tops is not going to be that big a deal. But at that point, it's not going to matter.
Because right. Everything else will have right. kind of filled it in.
Right, right. I mean, the strategy that Korea took was they kind of wanted to beat America at their own game, but they're not completely stupid. You know, they knew that they had to go about it from another angle. So what they did was, and they're continuing to do this, is they target countries that are too poor for America to care about. And they said, okay, we're gonna give these countries our dramas in, if necessary, for free. We will subsidize the translation. And then after a generation of watching these dramas, by the time these countries are rich enough for everyone to have a smartphone, which the way that things go might not be 20 years, it might be in 5 years, right? They will probably buy Samsung Galaxy because that's what they're using. That's what the alien is using on that on that soap opera, My Love from Another Star. Or, you know, and so it will already just have served its purpose. So I mean, and it's actually already happening. You know, in Iran, for example, there was a drama called Jumong, which was, I think it was literally like second century Korean costume drama, and I can't imagine why anybody would watch this who wasn't Korean. But it had 80% audience share. Wow. In Iran. That's more than the Olympics has ever had in the United States, for example. And there are a lot of reasons for this, actually. A big one is that there's some similarities in the cultures, you know, the family ties. You want your kid to be educated, but then if they're educated, they leave the home. But you know, if you love them, you have to let them go, blah, blah, blah. You know, I mean, that's, you know, and then going to America, like, you know, this mythical place for study. I mean, that it's very, there's a lot of similarity in the culture, but very, very crucially, Korean dramas are extremely chaste. There's typically no kissing until maybe episode 8 or 10. And there's always some kind of bizarre reason why they can't get in touch, like somebody gets into a car accident and has amnesia, or in the my favorite is
all the time in Korea, doesn't it? Apparently.
Yeah, I'm surprised we have a GDP at all. Like, nobody has any memory of anything. It's a miracle economy run by like
robots,
dementia. Yeah.
Exactly.
My favorite drama, you know, Korean drama, both to watch and to talk about because it's a perfect example, is My Love from Another Star, which right. is about an alien from outer space. He comes to Korea in, I think, 1609 or something, because that's where you would go if you had to pick anywhere on Earth. And
in 1609, yeah. it was. The shiz.
Right. He's like he foresaw that Korean men were the best, so he wanted to be a Korean. So he assumes the form of a Korean guy. And then fast forward to the 21st century, he falls in love with a Korean actress. And I don't want to give too much away, but like let's just say that there are health reasons. It's a life and death thing. Like it's kind of like Twilight in a way. Like if he gets together with her, then somebody's life might be endangered, and I won't go too far into it, but it's fairly predictable, but still. And, you know, this is something that you can show on Iran in prime time. And one thing that nobody could have predicted that weirdly benefited Korea is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in the last 20 years. So, I mean, like, if you look at pictures of Tehran, In the 1960s, there were gorgeous women wearing, you know, mini skirts, like, you know, like shorter than like, you know, girls' generation mini skirts, you know, leaning against a sports car with, you know, with dark glasses, and now obviously it's a different world. So you can, if you want to watch American soap operas in Iran or Yemen or any number of other places, you have to have a satellite, which, you know, it's not terrestrial. You have to have a satellite, which first of all means you're probably kind of rich. And even then, it's usually shown very, very late, like after midnight. Whereas a Korean drama can show prime time on terrestrial TV, so you can get it for free, and the whole family can actually watch it. So we have an entire generation of young people in the Islamic world who will be much more familiar with Korean dramas than with American dramas. That is mind-boggling.
It's like K-pop sleeper cells, essentially, around the world.
Yes.
It's like half hanbok, half hijab, kind of. But, I mean, that's probably very politically correct. But that said, I mean, I think that, you know, this leads to kind of the final question I want to ask you before opening up to the audience, which is, you know, where you do think this future is going to go. I mean, if Korea's designed a lot of this around five-year plans, after five-year plans, well, what's the next five-year plan? What happens after every person out there is infatuated with Korean space aliens and using Samsung Galaxy phones and whatnot? I mean, is there an end zone to this other than beating Sony and maybe even Hollywood, you know? Or will this sustain itself? And if so, what will it look like in a generation's time?
Well, I think Korea's plan since the 90s has always been, what is the next thing, as an open-ended question. They want to be ahead of it no matter what, which is why now they're putting in even faster internet that is going to be 200 times faster than what we have in the West. Does it need to be that fast? Not now, no, but it will be, and they just always want to be ahead of the curve. And if you want specifics, what I would say is going to be a big thing, a big Korean export, is I mentioned entertainment technology, which is a term I'd never heard before.
Or cultural
technology. I talked to somebody in the Ministry of Culture when I was researching this book. And the Ministry of Culture, in other words, taxpayer public funds from Korean taxpayers, are going toward think tanks. So the country's top scientists are working on, like I said, it's basically industrial light and magic. And it's purely for entertainment. It's not for warfare, because Korea can't really do that. They have a special relationship with America, and they can't really invade countries and stuff. So it's all going to be stuff like... they're working on like a super, super realistic 3D hologram. And the idea is that you can watch Girls' Generation or any given band anywhere in the world at the same time. Now, you do have holograms now, like, you know, P. Diddy did one or something, but it's not the same, because that's a 2D hologram. Somebody explained this to me in great detail, but that's a 2D hologram. So if you're standing right in front of the P. Diddy hologram, he looks like he's there, kind of. If you're standing next to him, you don't see anything, and if you're standing behind him, it still looks like the front, but an inverse image. Whereas they want something where it's actually 3D. So if you're standing in behind him, you see the back of his head. He's standing at the side of him, it looks like his side, and that's just one example of what they're working on. And if it turns out that nobody wants it, then they're just going to drop it. I mean, I think one Korean trait, you know, for better or for worse, is that they do not get married to ideas. They drop things if they're not working. So
they're willing to change literally everything in order to actually make, you know, that sort of next step of progress.
Yeah.
I've always suspected that at least four or five members of Girls' Generation are holograms, but you'll have to tell me. I mean, that's really fascinating. And I think that whole discussion about cultural technology and the idea that you would, as a country, invest in that kind of innovation, knowing that soft power and content and the ability to dominate minds and hearts and not just, you know, boundaries is the future. That's really incredible. And I mean, you know, we'll see what happens, again, 5 years down the road when you actually write the updated additional, you know, the rebirth of Korean Cool or something. But with that, let's open the floor up for some questions. I think we have a few minutes. Do we have a microphone that can go around or something? Okay, great. Oops, ouch. I just did something to my head. There, okay.
It's shoddy Korean technology.
All right, over here. Okay. Oh, wait for the mic to come over, I guess.
Hi. First, I just want to say thank you for writing this. I really enjoyed it, and I really loved your description at the end of how Korea is a neurotic with both a superiority and an inferiority complex, and dug that.
Thank you.
So I guess my question is kind of, you also say in the book that a lot of the milestones are brought about by individual artists. And I guess my question is, part of this conversation has been how a lot of these traditional values have continued to percolate through this somewhat progressive system. So I guess my question is, do you see that there's room for progressive artists, for progressive individuals, for kind of any kind of subversion? Or is it really just kind of maintaining the status quo?
That's a really good question. It's something that people don't feel comfortable talking about at the higher levels, you know, because Korea does not really have an indie scene. I mean, of course it does, but you have to physically be there to experience it. Like areas near Hongik-daekyo is famous for being like a bohemian kind of area, but that's not being packaged for export. I mean, so there isn't really even a tradition in Korea of people, you know, performing, of musicians performing in smoky cafes, waiting to be discovered. Right now, the model is the manufactured model because there, in Korea, this is true of the entertainment world in general, but in Korea, there is a huge disconnect between entertainment for money and high culture. Korea has separate funds for things like ballet, cinema, theater, but that's separate from export money. And they really are treating its exports of TV shows, pop music, video games, et cetera, as just like a packaged product, as a McDonald's or a Coca-Cola. It should be, they're, it's very tightly controlled, and you cannot control an individual artist. You know, they want to write their own songs. You can't have that. I mean, to some extent, yes, but it doesn't really fit into the K-pop model. It slows down the machine if the artist has their own ideas about things. It's a problem. It will always lie outside of the export strategy. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Hi, Yuni. So you talk about reluctantly embracing Korean coolness as a youth. And I wanted to know, when was that turning point when you started to realize, oh, Korea really is cool? And what do you think is the coolest thing in Korea today?
I became aware of Hallyu, the Korean wave, strangely enough, in France. I wasn't connected to the Korean community there at all. I mean, it's very small anyway. But I had friends from work. I was working at a French TV network. I had friends say, oh, I've been watching all these Korean movies. And I would say, oh, that's interesting. But I mean, French people like movies. So I just thought that was just what that was. And then like the following year, people started saying, I've been listening to a lot of music, Korean music. And I said, well, that's a little strange. And then people started saying that they are addicted to the dramas, which are, you know, which they get live streaming because, you know, France, well, the West, it was much slower in terms of live streaming than Asia. And so I'm talking about like 2007, 2008, that actually bandwidth became wide enough that people could start binge watching Korean dramas outside of Korea. And that's when when people started saying that in France, that's when I started to realize something weird was happening. And I was so uninterested that I didn't actually investigate whether it was happening outside of France. Which of course it was, it was completely bizarre. There was a K-pop concert going on when I was there, and it sold out in 15 minutes, literally, and the audience wasn't Korean, I didn't really realize until researching this book that it was genuinely global, and it wasn't just something that my friends were insisting was happening, you know, because it was wishful thinking.
So what was the coolest thing in Korea today?
What is the coolest thing in Korea today? I actually really like this TV producer that I met named Chung Tae-won, who did the Iris spy series. This is a genre that is a little bit of an outlier in terms of the Hallyu project. He is, I think, like, if there's going to be a breakthrough, you know, Korean producer aside from the conventional K-drama, it's going to be him, because there's totally no reason why Korea should not be making the world's best spy thrillers. It's the only, when I was growing up there, every single day was like an episode of Archer. You know, it's just like, you know, it's like, you know, it's just like they live in this cloak and dagger world every day. They live with the craziest person in the world, you know, just north of them, and there's no there's no reason why they should not be making the best in the world. I think that's going to be the next big thing.
Great, thanks.
Back there on the right.
Go ahead. Hi. I have a question first.
Oh, sorry, I didn't see you over there.
That's okay. Yeah. For both of you, I wonder if you could talk about the downside of this kind of, you know, external focus.
The downside? Well, by external focus, you mean like the emphasis on the Korea branding scheme? Well, one is, as the young lady pointed out, that it completely disregards anyone who's in the independent scene. They are not going to get around this problem for a while that they've been having, which is that there isn't a big entrepreneurial culture. It's probably the most serious problem, economic problem. I mean, North Korea is probably the most serious problem, but the most serious economic problem is the fact that the chaebols, no matter what they do, are still too powerful. There doesn't seem to be a reasonable way of undoing that, because why would you undo that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It would be crazy to ask Samsung to, you know, to scale back or work less hard. But there is not a very good entrepreneurial culture. It is a country that doesn't really, it still does not really reward creativity. If you went to the best universities and so forth, you decide you're going to go be an entrepreneur, your parents are not going to be happy about that at all, because it's still very name brand focused. And that is something that in the long term is probably going to hurt them. The focus on, you know, the biggest, Samsung is what people are recognizing, so we're going to make Samsung part of Korea, the brand. Girls' Generation is what people want, so we're going to emphasize that. If Psy had not made a billion hits, the Korean government would not have asked him to be in the, you know, the tourism board ads. It's really, 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 really hard to get the attention of this machine. So, I would say like the biggest practical problem would be that they're continuing to ignore the Steve Jobses of Korea and so forth. So.
Yeah, and the B-boys, right? I mean, there are, inflections of creativity that have actually become world-class in Korea that are not getting the same kind of attention and emphasis as K-pop and as K-dramas and as certain aspects of K-cinema, because they don't fit into those packages. Mm-hmm. I actually think that one thing we haven't talked about yet, but I think is one of the things that people are very fascinated about, and that is a very symptomatic, I guess, expression of the external focus of Korean culture right now is of course plastic surgery, right? And this notion of being willing to leave everything behind in the pursuit of getting better, progressing, being aspirational in some sense. There is a standardization even in beauty, in appearance,
right,
that ends up becoming as much a kind of stamp on, you know, the export of Korean culture as anything else. Maybe that's something you could talk a little bit about here, because I know it's something you probably get. It's probably the third thing you get asked about after Kim Jong-un, Han, that it's plastic surgery.
One thing that I did notice after interviewing all these Korean plastic surgeons is that there is actually a huge difference between plastic surgery in Korea and plastic surgery in the West, which is in the West, you know, they might want larger breasts or, you know, or this or that, but, you know, they have some idea in mind of what they want, and then they tell the doctor what they want, and then the doctor will do it. Whereas in Korea, there's like a perfect mean, there's a golden mean for everything. And I mentioned this in the book, but one doctor I interviewed literally just drew angles, and he said, like, a woman's nose, like, this should slant at a 95-degree angle and not a 100-degree angle, and for a man, it should be more this angle. It's extremely conformist. And I mean, I can't prove it, but I think the consultation period, the period when you're conferring with the doctor before you get the surgery, I think that the way that that goes in Korea is very much the doctor telling you what you really should get and what you really should not get. I think they don't just do what you ask them to do.
It's prescriptive on their
yes.
part.
Yes, yeah.
I actually met the same doctor, because I was thinking of writing about this phenomenon as well, from a slightly different angle. And I mean, he's brilliant and also a little bit crazy. And I think you kind of almost have to in order to... He actually runs a plastic surgery hospital. This is not a clinic. This is not a, you know, walk-in. It has like 75 beds or 100 beds or something. And they need these because the procedures they do, as Korea has become specialized in, aren't your just, you know, eye tucks or liposuction or whatever. They will literally squeeze you through the mold to get you, you know, shaving down your skull, rehang your jaw, everything necessary to actually make you, no matter what you start out with, look like a certain thing. And you know, he actually was talking about how empowered he felt when he chose plastic surgery, because he realized he always wanted to be an artist, you know, growing up, but his parents never let him do that. They said, that's a terrible thing, you know, for a young person to want to aspire towards. We want you to be a doctor because that is something people should aspire towards. So he chose the only path that would allow him to be a sculptor, essentially, and a doctor at the same time. And he sees human beings essentially as raw material to create these works of art.
And in fact, he has a gallery of sorts.
Oh my God, yes. In fact, one of the things he has, and this is a thing that kind of blew my mind and made me almost lose my lunch, is he has this giant container full of basically the jaw shavings, the peeled chunks of skull that have been removed from people who have gotten this particular surgery to make this V line, the pointed jaw, right? And you know, when I mentioned that this was really kind of grotesque, he was shocked. He's like, "What are you talking about? This is beautiful." There's actually a little quote as the caption to this giant thing, saying something about how, you know, what is exactly the quote? It's something like, you know, there's a legend that says that some animal, like an elephant or something, will always leave behind, you know, one of its tusks to the future generations. You know, here in this clinic, people leave behind a chunk of their skull. it's really remarkable in on some basic level that people are willing to go through these things aspirationally to improve themselves. And they, let's not get this wrong, there are people who actually do need this. I mean, you know, you look at the before and afters of these places.
Yeah, yeah. Like, did you bring the PowerPoint? Yeah, all our friends.
Oh God. Well, seriously,
the work they should get done. No.
Oh, I mean, you know, anyway, I don't want to get too carried away, but it's absolutely, you know, remarkable what these guys are able to do, and yet it's a symbol of something.
Right.
You know.
Of what?
I don't know. Change. Any more questions? Already have the mic back there.
So I can remember years ago, sort of on a lark, starting to watch some Korean soap operas and actually becoming completely addicted. And I remember finding, you know, the characters, right? There were a lot of very likable characters and they exhibited a lot of admirable traits. I mean, it was sort of a warm feeling. I mean, you wanted them to do well. You wanted them to overcome things. So It's not surprising to me that those dramas have universal appeal, you know, whether it's in Middle Eastern societies or other societies. It's a very human impulse that's being kind of driven home to the audience through them. So if I think about it, it doesn't necessarily seem to me that it needs to go away, you know, anytime soon, that the impulses that they, at least my recollection, they appeal to, if they're universal, you know, they're not gonna change. So I assume there is a potential, at least, for Korea to keep on producing content that many people in the world regard as very attractive and appealing. I'm curious, what is happening in Korea with regard to the consumption of creative content? That is it pretty much kind of a Korea-driven array of creative production that people are consuming? Is it Korea and America? Or is it sort of a global phenomenon? Korean content is penetrating the world. Is the reverse happening, or is it still relatively insular in terms of what is coming in, or open perhaps to American content, but not that open to other content?
Actually, I want to let Jeff answer this, because we were talking about this earlier, and you had some thoughts that were more interesting than mine. So.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I mean, you know, we were really talking more about, you know, the whole notion of exporting culture, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what has worked in the past and what hasn't. I mean, you know, we talked about Cool Japan, you know, and Japan's efforts to export its own particularly idiosyncratic culture to the world, and successfully in many ways. I mean, you know, in the animation space, in the gaming space, Japan is still kind of the player to beat. in so many ways. But at the same time, there's a sense in which, I mean, especially with Japan, and it's another country which I've written a lot about, the way that they actually reinvented themselves after their war, after World War II, was essentially this, to make the same kind of statement, we are going to, you know, it was the Sonys of the world back then, you know, Aki Morita and you know, his partners, who basically made the statement, we're going to rebuild. We're going to prove to the world that Japanese products actually can succeed. And in fact, that was the slogan Sony used, you know, that in its corporate philosophy, they said, we are going to be the company that proves to the world that Japan can make great products. And they did so for many generations. But the way they did it was essentially to create a firewall between Japan and the rest of the world. In Japan, they would make products that were idiosyncratically Japanese, right? They would create the, you know, the kind of crazy domestic market stuff that catered to the very unique needs, desires, and you know, preferences of Japanese consumers, and jack up the prices really high. The rest of the world, they're going to find, you know, use sort of that terrarium of Japan to identify the stuff that was exportable, because it did work for mass culture. It's sort of like, you know, if Japan was the theme park of technology and culture, whatever looked like it was, you know, super successful and massable, if you will, within Japan could then be kind of put outwards to the rest of the world. It was a strategy that worked for a long time until, obviously, Japan's own kind of reckoning, right? And, you know, when it realized that it couldn't actually keep on living off of its domestic consumption, essentially, to fuel an export-driven economy, they had a generation of lost souls, essentially, and still, to a certain extent, continuing. So Korea has to take a different path. And I guess sort of the question that you're asking is, what is it that is different, I guess, about what Korea is doing? Why is it that Korea, you know, might actually have a chance to have more than a generation's worth of success as an exporter of culture?
Well, this goes down to sort of the subtle cultural differences between Korea and Japan. Actually, they're not subtle. I think at the end of the day, if I can speak broadly, well, that's kind of what I'm paid to do now. Japan has retreated back into its original nature. And what I mean by that is they're always an inscrutable island nation that kind of really only cared about themselves. And there was a period where they were the export giants of the world. And now they're going back to caring mostly about themselves. And in fact, within Japanese, it's a slang, the Galapagos effect. The Galapagos Islands being a place that are so isolated that they have their own species of animals, and Japan basically kind of prides itself on being the same. And their companies are making stuff for the Japanese market that are not necessarily for export. It's part of it is the cultural belief. It might be exceptionalism, but they're just sort of like things, we do things differently. You know, our Coke cans are shaped like this, and every single other country's Coke cans are shaped like this. I mean, literally, that's the case. You know, they kind of don't care enough. And they don't need to. They can actually self-sustain by just making stuff for themselves and consuming. Partly they have a large population, partly it's a culture that buys a lot of stuff. Like they don't keep the same TV for 20 years like most Americans do. When they move, they leave their old electronics on the curb for the, you know, for the rubbish man to take away, because they just want to buy all new stuff. So they can totally just feed their own economy. Korea doesn't do that. They do spend a lot, but not to that extent, and it's a smaller population, and they can't self-sustain, so they have to always be export focused. I mean, pretty much they can't afford not to be.
It's interesting because, I mean, obviously Korea used to be known as the Hermit Kingdom.
Right.
It was very insular and very, you know, kind of walled off from the world.
Right.
Once that bubble was kind of ruptured, and the country itself was essentially ruptured, there was no going back, I guess.
Right. Right. Unlike Japan, which sort of decided, well, let's just, you know, we actually kind of liked it the way it was before. And in Korea, when things change, they really change. So, you know, for better or for worse.
May I just ask another question that our guest had mentioned with regard to that, you know, when you get out of college or whatever in Korea, that if you want to set up if you want to go the entrepreneurial route, mm-hmm. that's not necessarily encouraged. It seems to me that there's like a fundamental disconnect. You know, you hear about people like working around the clock to, you know, memorize and get into these, you know, do the testing for the testing requirements and all this stuff and follow the standard route and join the big conglomerates and, you know, have a good life, etc. And yet, you know, I can remember with regard to Samsung that there was a time many years ago in New York City that suddenly out of the blue, it seemed to me that on every bus stop, there was a Samsung poster. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was like these cool people, you know, in black and white. And that was so contrary to my perception, and I think many people's perception of who and what Samsung was. But the people at Samsung had imagined an entirely different reality. And they had had not just the guts, but they'd had the imagination and the creativity to do it. So to me, you know, it's okay, there's this rote memorization fitting into whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And yet, with regard to not just, you know, create from creative content to what has been done on the industrial side, it requires not just guts, but it requires incredible vision and imagination and creativity. So it's coming from somewhere, you know, and so when people kind of denigrate the system and how people are prepared and how the options mm-hmm. are, you know, cut off for them, it seems I understand what they're saying and I appreciate mm-hmm. it. And yet there's this enormous, you know, enormous body of evidence and energy and accomplishment that is mm-hmm. completely contrary to that. It's fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
There's still that, you know, desire for bloodthirsty revenge to go with. Anyway, sorry.
No, okay. At the end of the day, I mean, of course, you know, any Korean would be proud to hear you use those words or creative and so forth to describe them. But at the end of the day, they're just really good problem solvers. They don't think about, I mean, of course they think about things, they cogitate, but you know, it's a country that is that really looks down on excuses. You just have to, Sonny's nodding. So if you grew up in a, you know, don't complain and don't explain, you know, just, I mean, in Samsung, of course, there are, you know, brilliant minds behind it, but the best decisions they made were entirely business decisions. Like the, if I had to pick one thing, it would be that they bet on, it was, you know, in the 90s, it was going to be either analog or digital in terms of everything, radio, TV, whatever. The U.S. was stubbornly analog, and there was an argument to be made that you should invest in analog. Samsung said, no, we're going to go digital, and not because we're visionaries and we know digital is the future. We're going to do digital for a completely pragmatic reason, which is that we don't have to catch up to make, it's all ones and zeros. It's literally ones and zeros. You can have a terrible factory, you know, with really bad conditions, and it'll still work or it won't work. It's completely binary. So that's kind of how the semiconductor boom happened. And it wasn't necessarily based on like Steve Jobs' famous speech. Well, I didn't see him give it. I saw Ashton Kutcher give it, but because in the movie where he takes an iPod, Ashton Kutcher or Steve, but the real thing must have been almost as good. He takes an iPod out of his pocket. He goes, "This is, you know, 1,000 songs. It's your dream. It's your life in a pocket." And Korean people do not talk like that. They don't. It's not how they think. They're not visionaries. They are, but not in the way that you might think of it. They're just really, really good problem solvers. So there's an unromantic explanation behind everything that's behind the word cool. There's actually like a total grind behind it. So
I think it's fascinating because here in America,
yeah.
cool is about effortlessness.
Right.
Right? It's about waking up, rolling out of bed, and like, I'm already awesome, right?
Yeah.
But I think Korea, and throughout Asia, but I think Korea especially, you don't get to cool unless you've already put in, you know, 30 years of work,
yeah.
your mandatory army service, you know, yeah. everything necessary. And then maybe you get to like begin cool, you know, begin the whole art of cool. How much time do we have? Maybe one, two?
Yeah. I've sort of seen drama from all over the world. and I've seen Korean drama, and it always draws me in. I'm just wondering, what can you identify the elements that are so I'm manipulating my emotions in my mind when I watch Korean drama?
Actually, I'd like us both to answer this, because I have a feeling that he's more addicted than he lets on. He's probably clocked in three times more hours than he'll admit. But my answer to that is, well, there's a couple of things. One is, if there's a number one virtue in Korea, the word is chakkhada, which it's basically means good, but it's more that it's pure of heart. And, you know, in English, if you describe somebody as being pure of heart, that's a bit wet. I mean, that's, nobody wants that said about them. But in Korea, it's the catch-all for this is a good person. You can hire this person. You can marry this person. That's something that you really see in the Korean dramas, where just somebody's just good, in this sort of very fundamental way, not just nice, not just polite, but just fun, has a pure heart, and the outcome might not be good, you know, because life is terrible and bad things happen to good people. But, you know, there's this inner core of unbreakable goodness that, you know, that they strive for. That's the first thing. And the second thing is this sort of like never-ending longing that is so much a part of every single drama. You know, I call it the Twilight effect. I mean, people ask why Korean dramas are so popular. It's like, well, Koreans did not. Stephanie Meyer is just as smart as anybody making these dramas, because she made billions and billions of dollars by having a love affair that could not be consummated. And I think that...
Spoiler, it's consummated.
Damn it. And that's basically what a Korean drama is too. It can't be consummated. And I think that Twilight was the first time in the West that Hollywood executives realized, oh, there might actually be a market for this. We didn't know. And Koreans kind of always knew, because that was just part of the, it was always Twilight. Yeah. So,
well, I mean, I think there are two pieces of that. One is, you know, I think that there's some truth to that. Like, at least in the Northwest, right? I mean, in the South of the Southern Hemisphere, you know, part of the Western Hemisphere, you know, telenovelas and the like have kind of hit on similar tropes, mm-hmm. right? That notion of really kind of amping up the emotional content. So mm-hmm. everything is consequential. Even a single look, a single stare, it's like, oh, we can mm-hmm. obsess over that for a long time. I mean, you know, because there's so much more at stake, it feels like mm-hmm. in every episode, every scene, every... It builds up this gigantic amount of tension, mm-hmm. And then the catharsis becomes that much more consequential as a result as well.
Right.
You know, if it occurs. I mean, mm-hmm. some just sort of like trail off and, you know, SOL, whatever. But I think the really from the storytelling aspect, and I'm not really addicted to them. I have to, you know, I've watched them, and I'm attracted to the craft, but. You know, one of the things that I think is crafty about K-dramas is that they really are telling stories. I mean, there's an arc for each of the characters mm-hmm. and a beginning and an end to what we're seeing. Whereas in America, only recently did we get to a point where television creators realized that there was something to be said for ending stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You're seeing it now in things like American Horror Story or True Detective, where episodics that actually do have an arc, a single season arc, and characters that do begin and end are becoming important to television and its renaissance. But all that has already been the case in mm-hmm. in Asia and in Latin America, and it's nothing new in some ways. So mm-hmm. I'd say that that's a big part of what makes them so addictive.
Thank you.
Hi. Nice to meet you, Yuni, and thank you, Jeff, for a really enlightening talk. So you talked a lot about the different influences and the export of, you know, Korean culture through K-pop, drama. But another area that we're seeing, you know, a huge popularity about is Korean food. Mm. So I would love to get your insights on, one, what do you see the Korean government doing in terms of using Korean food as a cultural export? And then also your thoughts on the Korean American food movement here with the likes of David Chang and Roy Choi, you know, who are sort of redefining Korean food in a, dare I say, fusion way. So yeah, that's my question.
Yes. people are very shocked to learn that even the popularity of Korean food worldwide is also kind of government sponsored. I mean, it's genuinely good. It wouldn't have spread, but there was a government sponsored movement called Hanshik that was, and former president Lee Myung-pak's wife was very heavily involved in it. That involved, they would basically give scholarships to chefs around the world, either at culinary schools or from famous restaurants, to come to Korea and study. They would fly them in, they would give them a stipend, and they would study Korean cooking for free. And then they would go back and either some of them would open a food truck, some of them would open a Korean restaurant, and some of them would just do whatever the restaurant they were already doing, but just incorporate flavors, sort of experiment. You know, I was at a restaurant in Boston the other day that had something called kimchi oil. It was something with kimchi. I don't really know what that is. But, it reverberates because people genuinely like it. But the government had a lot to do with it. I think they're going about it the wrong way now, though, because the bibimbap pictures always appear in these tourism ads. And I don't think that really does anything. I actually interviewed a chef, Hoonhee Kim, for this book, and he was the one who said, why do they have pictures of bibimbap? It doesn't look good, and pictures of food just don't do anything for Korea. It's totally going about this the wrong way. And I think he's onto something. They're just being way too conservative in some ways. It's definitely, as you mentioned, like the David Changs, who are, their real food experimentation is happening outside of Korea. And I just want to mention, interestingly, that the Nestle Professional Food Trend Report for 2014 predicted that gochujang and Korean fried chicken were going to be the next big trends.
Back in 2009 or
whatever, man. Like, there's people are behind, yeah. Korea was actually the only country that was singled out on this trend list. So,
I think that there's one of the things that's sort of interesting about, even in the book, how you talk about Korean food is this whole notion of kimchi, right? And how it's this food of, you know, kind of desperation, mm-hmm. Tied you through the winter months, you know, and it smells terrible, but, you know, it's got all these vitamins and stuff in it. So, but at the same time, it's something which people grew up in some ways historically, you know, being a little ashamed of. We're eating, mm-hmm. you know, food that smells, and you come to America and, oh my God, I can't bring out my lunch. For what it's worth, Chinese people, when we, you know, have stinky food, we hide it. You know, we create separate kitchens for just the Chinese cooking and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Koreans are like, no, we're going to force this stuff down. You're going to like kimchi, you're going to eat it, and you're going to, you know, thank us for it. And it worked. I mean, I think there's something really, you know, fascinating about how Korean food has become an additive, hybridization opportunity mm-hmm. for cuisine, you know, as mm-hmm. opposed to something where the authentic cuisine is kept in one part of the world, and then, you know, the mass marketed stuff goes out through the front panda gate or something like that. Anyway, just a little musing there. I think we're pretty much out of time, but thank you guys so much for joining us. I hope you had a good time. I certainly did.
Thank you. Oh, completely off topic. I wanted to make a plug for Jeff's son, Hudson Yang, who is the star of an ABC sitcom airing when?
In January,
called Fresh Off the Boat. And there's a very important scene, episode one, that talks about embarrassing Asian food. and his son has asked for white people food. So please watch it.
Yes, in January. Yay.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors. Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for information about memberships and to learn more about all the programs available at the Korea Society.